I actually meant to read this during the Brew of the Week, and then I got distracted. It's called Beer for Water, Help the the Coastal Watershed Coalition, and have some local brew. Mark your calendars. Next Thursday, October 14th, the Coastal Watershed Council will earn $1 for every pint of beer purchased at the Santa Cruz Mountain Brewing Company. As part of their Thank You Thursdays program, the brewery donates $1 for each beer purchased anytime that day, and they're open from noon to 10 p.m., so there's plenty of times to get in there and support the Coastal Watershed Council. There's more to this, but I'm not going to read it because it becomes more and more like a commercial. But it is for a good cause. The Coastal Watershed Council does go out in the spring. They do a snapshot day where they collect water samples from every stream in Santa Cruz County, actually up and down the coast, everywhere within the Monterey Bay sanctuary. But then, of course, you probably already knew that. They also do first flush. They're getting ready to take their first water samples of the year. Of all that water that flushes down storm drains and gets into our streams with all that pollution from our roads and lawns and backyards and everything else. So if you'd like to help the Coastal Watershed Council and drink some beer at the same time, it's next Thursday from noon till 10 p.m., the Santa Cruz Mountain Brewing Company out on the west side at Ingalls Street is the place to do it. And we, of course, are kicking back with our Brew of the Week here, the Imperial Chocolate Stout in the illegal bottle from Rogue Brewing. So, all right. That's enough funny business. It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And we're going to start out with an announcement here. The San Lorenzo Valley Water District is going to be having a public planning meeting concerning the Olympia watershed. This is going to take place Wednesday, October 13th from 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at the Zianti Firehouse. That's on Zianti Road, I hope you know. The San Lorenzo Valley Water District seeks public participation in the planning process. They're going to hold a special public meeting to address the future management of the district's Olympia watershed property. You're invited to provide input on the issues. Tell us your concerns, ideas, and recommendations for the Olympia watershed's future management, resource protection, and visitor use. They'll provide maps and give a short presentation about the history and resources of the Olympia watershed property. The meeting will be facilitated by the firm called Design, Community, and Environment. And your input will be used to develop the district's management and implementation plan for the Olympia watershed property. They will serve refreshments. There's free parking in the firehouse parking lot. Just don't park in front of the fire engines. And for more information, contact the San Lorenzo Valley Water District at their website, slvwd.com. And keep your calendar marked for Wednesday, October 13th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. Zianti Firehouse for that important public meeting. Also coming up next weekend, not this weekend, next weekend, folks, the Monterey Green Fest is going to debut at the Monterey County Fairgrounds on Saturday, October 9th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Moderate admission, but they don't have any senior rates. I wondered about that. I guess you'd grow old, you have to pay for it. They'll be sustaining the fun for everyone as the theme of this inaugural event. Special parking if you drive your electric vehicle, free bike parking, they'll have wine, food, music, they'll have outreach for kids, they'll have everything. Great stuff. Anyway, keep checking the website at MontereyGreenFest.com for more information and updates on that whole thing coming up next weekend. And another dam repair in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. Wilderness Watch is seeing an alarming number of proposals to use motorized equipment to repair dams in the wilderness. Many of the projects exclude full public participation and proper environmental review. The most recent is the Canyon Lake Dam. The Forest Service recently declared the situation at Canyon Lake an emergency, even though the sinkhole was discovered months ago, and no efforts have been made to repair it throughout the summer. The emergency declaration cuts short the public comment period and environmental review. Wilderness Watch's Executive Director George Nickus was quoted in the Missoula Independent as saying it's part of the same old phony story. The Forest Service told everyone they could comment and even appeal the decision, but it doesn't matter because they're going in to do the work now. How are we going to weigh in when they keep subverting the process? Unquote. The Bitterroot National Forest contains 16 wilderness dams in total. Most, like Canyon Lake, are more than 100 years old and were constructed with primitive materials and, of course, without bulldozers and cranes or any of that stuff. To meet increased dam safety standards, they require constant maintenance and repair by the separate irrigation districts that own them. Each of these projects must in turn gain approval from the Forest Service. Sometimes things have no urgency associated with them, and other times they do, says CCID Commissioner Brian Bachman. The Forest Service recognizes that, and they work in the best interest of the public. Bachman says there's no question helicopters and motorized equipment provide a more efficient and expedient way to complete those projects. He says the concrete and tools needed to repair the Canyon Lake sinkhole and insert a membrane along the dam to prevent future erosion would be much harder if transport by the CCID were to use pack stock as required under the Wilderness Act of 1964. In other words, it's just too much trouble to obey the law. And they claim the undertaking would significantly degrade the trail to the dam as well. Well, I mean, they could fix the trail, too. Nicholas doesn't refuse the urgency of repairs at Canyon Lake, nor does he deny that helicopter flights leave less of a mark on the land than hordes of mules carrying heavy gear, but he maintains motorized use of any kind in the Bitterroot National Forest is a clear violation of federal law. And he says he's seeing emergency situations declared almost annually now. What typically happens is not an iota difference than what we're seeing at Canyon Creek this summer, Nicholas says. As soon as someone steps in to challenge it, the Forest Service declares it's an emergency. Oh, life and limb is threatened downstream. We have to roll over and let this happen. That's how they deal with these wilderness dams. They did it with Tin Cup. Tin Cup Dam, located southwest of Darby, has been the focus of two separate emergency declarations by the Forest Service in the past 13 years. Both times, Nicholas and the Wilderness Watch have rallied against the use of helicopters and heavy equipment, but to no avail. In their latest battle over the issue, Wilderness Watch and Idaho-based Friends of the Clearwater appealed a proposal from the Tin Cups Water and Sewer District this summer. The proposal calls for a major reconstruction project to double the reservoir's capacity. Tin Cup isn't the first one, and it won't be the last one. If the Forest Service and water users have their way, they'll just be allowing more and more and more motorized equipment up there, Nicholas says. District Manager Gary Mortimer says the need for maintenance is less urgent at Tin Cup than Canyon Lake now, but he has responsibilities to the irrigators in the Tin Cup drainage. The district's ability to store enough water for the needs of local landowners has declined, Mortimer says, and safety is always an added concern. There's always the safety issue, Mortimer says. In fact, that's what I've stressed. We want to make sure that dam holds if that dam ever broke, and not that it's in any danger of it now. That would wipe the canyon out and everyone living in it. For now, Tin Cup District is in a stalemate with Wilderness Watch and Friends of the Clearwater, but work will begin on schedule for Canyon Lake despite wilderness regulations Nicholas feels the Forest Service should be enforcing. For King, it's a difficult decision every time an irrigation district puts this form of request through. This is ongoing. It's never-ending, she says. In my mind, I'm thinking, we'll get this done and it'll be done, but it does seem like there's a constant need for access, and it does get to be an accumulative effect. Well, that's about as close as they could do. You can find more information out at www.wildernesswatch.org, but here's an update on the Tin Cup appeal. In an earlier news release, we just reported on the efforts of Wilderness Watch and Friends of the Clearwater to convince the Forest Service to consider non-motorized alternatives for repair work on the Tin Cup Dam in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness in Montana. The Forest Service had authorized helicopter flights and heavy equipment to rebuild the dam, although when the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness was designated in 1964. The Secretary of Agriculture promised the American people that dams in the wilderness would continue to be maintained as they had been built without motorized equipment. Since the late 1990s, when Forest Service approved so-called emergency work on Tin Cup with heavy equipment and helicopters, agency officials have promised the public a thorough environmental impact statement prior to any other reconstructions. That promise was broken when the Forest Service completed only a less rigorous environmental analysis, which neither analyzed a non-motorized option nor allowed public comment. Wilderness Watch is reviewing their options as the regional office denied our appeal this month in that news from wildernesswatch.org. And protests against high-speed rail continue in Spain. Just a week after holding a gathering against high-speed trains, the squatted farmhouse of Lingentexi has been demolished. This farmhouse served as a base in the last months for the resistance against the high-speed train. There was a vigil protest at Zenorta, Spain, that evening. Meanwhile, three people await trial at the High Court accused of participating in a symbolic protest action against the high-speed train. The activists painted a tram which was passing next to a demonstration against the train. They also spread sand on the rails, planted a flower as a symbolic protest. They faced 3 years of imprisonment and 24 months and 9 years of disqualification from working in institutions, and that means pretty much anything in Spain. The reason for such a high penalty is that the High Court is prosecuting them for, quote, following ETA's slogans against the high-speed train, unquote. ETA is an armed Basque separatist group that has been battling Spanish and French rule for 5 decades. The mayor of the town, Azier Aguirre, was sentenced to 7 years disqualification from political posts, working as the mayor, for instance, and from working in any institution. The only reason was to convene a consultation in this town affected by the high-speed rail, while this was agreed into in a council meeting and wasn't supported by him. He was elected by ANV, the party which stands against the high-speed train and which was illegalized by the Spanish administration, but not on the French side. In an alleged democracy like Spain, an exercise of expressing ourselves was banned by a court of administrative litigation. And we'll try and keep up on that one. Don't know where that one's going to go. And here's a little comment on fall. Poisoning by leaf smoke is a rite of fall. The smell of leaf smoke on a crisp October day is a symbol of autumn for many people. It's a potential death sentence for others. People who see no harm in burning leaves presumably don't have close friends or loved ones who suffer from lung disorders such as asthma, chronic bronchitis, pulmonary emphysema, or cystic fibrosis. If they did, surely they would be aware of the effect of smoke on those who struggle for every breath. Many of us have fond memories of autumn bonfires, but the reality is smoke and ash produced from leaf burning releases fine particles, carbon monoxide, and hydrocarbons into the air, says Rebecca Humphreys, a director of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources and the Environment. Leaf smoke is visible because tiny particles capable of reaching the deepest parts of the lung, where they can trigger asthma attacks and other breathing problems. These particles remain in the lungs for decades, impairing function and increasing the long-term risk of disease. Ketones, aldehydes, and other hydrocarbons released by leaf burning are known as carcinogens. Ironically, some of the more aromatic gases, the very things that provide leaf smoke with its memorable odor, are also the most deadly. The visible smoke is nasty, but what we cannot see are maybe even more dangerous. Leaf burning releases invisible gases, including carbon monoxide, which is absorbed into the bloodstream. This reduces the amount of oxygen supplied to the brain, the heart, and other organs. That may not be a big deal for a healthy individual, but it can do irreparable damage to unborn children, the newborn, and the elderly. No pregnant woman should willingly expose herself to leaf smoke. These health risks have been widely known for many years. In 1988, the Michigan Air Pollution Control Commission called on local communities to ban the open burning of leaves, grass clippings, and other yard waste. 15 years ago, the state legislature and Governor John Engler went a step further and outlawed open burning in cities and townships with populations of 7,500 or more. Burn permits are required everywhere else. A permit is no shield from liability. If a fire gets out of control, the Michigan State University Extension Service estimates that careless burning causes as many as 4,000 wildfires annually in Michigan. What to do? Well, mulching and composting are the obvious alternative to burning. The easiest option is a simple one. Just mow the leaves until they are chopped into a fine mulch and leave it over the winter. That's it. You're done. In effect, you'll be fertilizing your soil and lawn with the most natural of nutrients. And Argentine lawmakers pass a glacier law to curb mining. In this story by Helen Popper and Luis Andres Haneo, with editing by John Pasinich of the World Environment News Thomson Reuters. Argentina's Senate passed a law on Thursday that curbs mining on the nation's glaciers, a measure praised by environmentalists but criticized by supporters of the industry as a detriment to investment. Senators approved the law with 35 votes in favor and 33 against after hours of debate, eventually agreeing to accept changes made in the lower house that pro-mining provinces had opposed. President Cristina Fernandez, who angered Green campaigners by vetoing a similar law 2 years ago, has indicated she will now sign this law. She blocked it previously on the grounds it would hamper the growth of provincial economies. Analysts say it could make more expensive or even impossible for the world's biggest gold producer, Barrick Gold Corporation, to develop the huge Pascua Lama site high in the Andes, although the company says that the ore body it has permission to mine does not lie on a glacier. Mining-friendly provincial governments such as Northern San Juan might try to challenge the law in the Supreme Court, arguing that it is their responsibility to decide how to manage their natural resources. Anti-mining sentiment is strong in the South American country, making debate over the glacier law a sensitive political issue a year from the next presidential election. And back here in the United States, the Gunnison sage-grouse has been granted a warranted but precluded decision, which is another disappointment, says leading bird conservation group. A decision by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that the Gunnison sage-grouse is warranted for inclusion on the endangered species list but precluded because of other considerations is another disappointing non-action by the agency charged with protecting the nation's wildlife, according to the American Bird Conservancy. The Gunnison sage-grouse numbers fewer than 4,000 birds and occupies only about 10% of its historic range, placing this bird on the candidate list for endangered species protection at some unnamed point is an abdication of responsibility, said ABC President George Fenwick. Right now, there are 250 species on the ESA candidate list, some of which have been there for 30 years. This decision simply perpetuates the status quo with no expectation of a different outcome, Fenwick said. ABC has called for the ESA listing of this Gunnison sage-grouse. Most recently in its new book, The American Bird Conservancy Guide to Bird Conservation, described as the most authoritative book on bird conservation ever published. The Gunnison sage-grouse is listed as globally endangered under the IUCN World Conservation Union criteria. In March of this year, the Fish and Wildlife Service decided that a similar bird, the greater sage-grouse, also was warranted for inclusion on the endangered species list, but precluded from listing for now. The Gunnison sage-grouse is characterized by a smaller body size than its relative, with unique plumage. It is found in only 6 or 7 counties in Colorado and 1 in Utah. The Gunnison Basin in Colorado comprises over half the species' entire world range. The Gunnison sage-grouse uses different habitats for breeding, nesting, brood rearing, and wintering at various times of the year. Breeding ground habitat is dominated by low open vegetation with sagebrush areas. Nesting takes place within the sagebrush community. Brood rearing habitat is along the edges of and into meadows and riparian areas with a large grass component and a high percentage of forbs. Winter habitat, on the other hand, is primarily determined by snow depth. Sage-grouse eat only sagebrush leaves during the winter and often can only find exposed plants in drainages with specific characteristics. Other areas used during the winter include windswept mesas and ridgetops. For the grouse, all these habitats are important. The pressing needs of the Gunnison sage-grouse continue to be the loss, degradation, and fragmentation of habitat from various land uses and the use of all-terrain vehicles. ABC and other conservation groups are calling on the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Land Management to develop a regional management plan for sage-grouse to address the multiple management challenges protecting the species' vast but fragile habitat. If you'd like more information, visit the website of the American Bird Conservancy at www.abcbirds.org. And hungry bears spell trouble for humans in the Rockies. In this story by Laura Zuckerman, with editing by Steve Gorman, Jonathan Otis, and Sandra Mahler, of the World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A shortage of berries and other foods that hungry bears normally rely on to bulk up before hibernation has sent conflicts with humans spiraling to unprecedented levels in the Rocky Mountain West this year. Wildlife officials in parts of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming say they are experiencing a record year for so-called problem bears, which wander from the wilds into civilization and into trouble. State and federal bear biologists say they are overrun this season with reports about errant grizzly and black bears foraging in everything from garbage cans to garages, in every place from golf courses to city centers. I've had as many as 20 calls a day, said Tim Manley, a grizzly bear management specialist with the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department. Scientists say bears this year are wrestling with challenging conditions. For starters, the mild winter meant bears emerged from their dens in the spring, encountered fewer weakened or winter-killed wildlife like elk to prey on. The late spring snow, which blanketed the high country and pushed bears to lower elevations earlier, delayed or even destroyed the crop of fruit-bearing shrubs bears favor, such as huckleberries and hawthorns. Conflicts between wildlife and humans almost always center on food, and when supplies of nourishment are low in the mountains, bears congregate closer to the valleys where people live and livestock is conveniently located. Manley, based in the Flathead Valley of northwest Montana, is among wildlife agents tracking 18 grizzlies, more than the usual number, that have been trapped since spring and in most cases relocated, a strategy for managing nuisance bears without killing them. In neighboring Wyoming, the problem is more pronounced. Wildlife officials have grappled with a record 52 grizzly captures stemming from conflicts with people and livestock, said Mark Brusino, head of the bear program for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. That's double the number from an average year. Bears are getting bolder and seeking foods, Brusino said. The trend for grizzlies, outsized hump-shouldered bears listed as threatened species in and around Yellowstone National Park, is compounded this year by a decline in the white-barked pine, a high-elevation tree whose nuts make up a crucial part of the grizzly bear diet. And we reported before about that problem on Earth First Radio. Chuck Schwartz, the head of a group of government scientists who monitor the estimated 600 grizzlies in the Yellowstone region, parts of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, said conflicts with bears invariably arise when food supplies fail. If a natural food source is scarce, bears don't curl up and die, they just go looking for something to eat, he said. Both grizzlies and black bears are considered opportunistic omnivores, meaning the animals will switch from fruit to fish, from nuts to meat, or any combination in between according to the dictates of their environment. That drive for food turned deadly on July 28th when a mother grizzly killed a camper and injured two others at a Montana campground. Earlier that month, a grizzly killed an elderly hiker in northwestern Wyoming. By contrast, encounters this year with black bears have been tame but prolific. A woman near Missoula, Montana, recently fended off a charging bear with a zucchini. In central Idaho, residents have reported bears raiding bird feeders, guzzling from water jugs, and raiding beehives. We're seeing an unusual amount of bear activity this year, said Brett Stansberry, a wildlife biologist with the Idaho Fish and Game Office in Salmon, Idaho. It will be late October before most black bears will have entered their dens, where they will snooze away the winter. Grizzlies, on the other hand, don't usually den down until the end of November, so there's be a few more days there for grizzlies to get in their food after the black bears have gone to bed. And unfortunately, the pygmy rabbit, won't be getting species protected in the United States. In the story by Laura Zuckerman, with editing by Ed Stoddard and Peter Bohan of the World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. The hardships faced by the pygmy rabbit of the western United States don't warrant protections under the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced. The pygmy rabbit is the smallest and one of only two rabbits in North America that create their own burrows. An adult is from 9 to 12 inches in length and weighs a half a pound to a pound, about 440 grams. We find that there has been some loss and degradation of pygmy rabbit habitat range-wide, but not to the magnitude that constitutes a significant threat to the species, says Bob Williams, supervisor of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Nevada. A population of pygmy rabbits in eastern Washington was listed as endangered in 2003 after its numbers dwindled. This recent decision affects the species where it is found in California, Nevada, Oregon, Idaho, Utah, Wyoming, and Montana. The pint-sized rabbit may be small, but the stakes are high, as such a listing could throw up regulatory hurdles to energy or farming projects that require federal approval or funds. Environmentalists had petitioned the government to list the population in the seven western states, arguing the sagebrush range they depend on was under assault from ranching and energy activities, among other things. While environmental groups had sought the listing, were quick to say the decision means the rabbit will be imperiled to the point of extinction, scientists were more cautious. What's a little bit different about this species in this day and age is that its ecology is not yet understood, said Janet Racklow, an expert on pygmy rabbits and the University of Idaho professor specializing in mammal ecology. Beth Waterbury, a biologist with the Idaho Fish and Game Office in Salmon, Idaho, said of her 9 years study of the species, "We don't have all the pieces of the puzzle yet." But Eric Molvar, wildlife biologist with the Biodiversity Conservation Alliance in Wyoming, one of the groups that sought the listing, said there is no question pygmies face severe threats throughout their range. Molvar faulted the Obama administration for decisions this year denying immediate protections for sagebrush-dependent species like the pygmy rabbit and the sage grouse. And on to some more biological diversity news. The court upholds safeguards for steelhead trout. A federal appeals court has rejected an attempt to strip Endangered Species Act protections from California's Central Valley steelhead trout. The ocean-going steelhead population has been federally protected for more than a decade, and numbers of fish have declined drastically due to habitat destruction from dams, water diversions, urban and agricultural development, and other threats. But corporate irrigation interests sued the National Marine Fisheries Service, claiming the fish aren't imperiled because they can breed with the resident rainbow trout. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed, pronouncing that migratory steelhead are unique in behavior and biology, are essential to maintaining wild trout populations, and deserve continued federal protection. The Center for Biological Diversity intervened in a lawsuit in defense of the steelhead. "We've been helping save West Coast steelhead since 1999, when we launched a successful suit that earned federally protected critical habitat for numerous populations of these fish." And the 10,000th endangered leopard frog has been released into the wild. "One small hop for an endangered amphibian represented a giant leap for his entire kind recently, when the 10,000th Chiricahua leopard frog was released into the wild through a reintroduction program in Arizona. The latest release brought 1,500 of the young frogs, known for their distinctive snore-like call, from their hatching place in the Phoenix Zoo Conservation Center all the way to the Tonto National Forest, where they hopped into pools to start their new lives. And they'll need plenty of monitoring and protection to stay alive. Livestock grazing, groundwater pumping, water diversion, and dams have decimated their southwest riparian habitat, while non-native predators eat the frogs, and disease, pesticides, and climate change present even more threats. It's no surprise that the Chiricahua leopard frogs, which need permanent water in their habitat for reproduction, have declined more than any other frog in Arizona. But the frog earned a new hope for survival after winning Endangered Species Act protection in 2002 as a result of a 1998 petition and two lawsuits by the Center for Biological Diversity. "Since it got a place on the endangered species list, we've kept up the fight for the sensitive herb, HERP, suing to protect it on national forest and participating in the crafting of its federal recovery plan." The latest milestone, says the center's Noah Greenwald, shows that getting a species added to the list really does lead to action. And a suit defends ice seal species threatened by warming. In a lawsuit with important implications for species threatened by global warming, the Center for Biological Diversity and allies are in court to earn the ice-dependent ribbon seal another chance at protection. "We filed a scientific petition to protect the seal threatened by the warming-caused melting of its Arctic habitat in 2007, but the National Marine Fisheries Service declined it in 2008, claiming enough sea ice would remain by 2050 that the seal would survive until then." Not only did this conclusion ignore numerous studies by independent scientists as well as the agency's own data, that it also was too short-sighted, relying on projections going just 42 years into the future. "Our suit will show, among other things, that looking less than half a century ahead isn't enough to say climate risks aren't foreseeable under the Endangered Species Act." And the largest North American amphibian has been proposed for protection after a petition and lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced it proposed to protect the Ozark hellbender salamander under the Endangered Species Act. This strictly aquatic salamander, which can grow to be 2 feet long, is found only in rivers and streams in northern Arkansas and southern Missouri, where it's threatened by rampant habitat destruction and other dangers. After the service merely put the hellbender on its candidate list in 2001, putting off federal protections indefinitely, the center petitioned to expedite protection for this and more than 200 candidates, following up our petition with a lawsuit. That That suit is still pending in federal court, with a decision expected any day. The proposed listing of the Ozark Hellbender is cause for celebration, said Colette Adkins-Geese, newly hired center lawyer and likely the world's first attorney focusing solely on protecting rare amphibians and reptiles. The Ozark Hellbender faces many threats to its survival, including water quality fouled by mining, fertilizer runoff, and animal operations. Protection under the Endangered Species Act would give this species a fighting chance. And Montana fish warrants protection, but the feds are still delaying. In a response to a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity and its allies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced the Montana fluvial Arctic grayling deserves federal protection, but is precluded from receiving it. We've heard that before. The beautiful silvery purple fish with its sail-like dorsal fin was identified for possible Endangered Species Act protections way back in 1982, by then existing in less than 5% of its original range. It has continued to decline dramatically in its last remaining river home, Montana's Big Hole River, which nearly dries up every year due to increased irrigation use and drought. After a 1991 scientific petition, the feds declared protection for the grayling warranted but precluded because other species were deemed a higher priority. The agencies agreed to revisit the decision after a 2003 lawsuit, only to deny the fish protection altogether. Now, after we filed yet another lawsuit in 2007, the fish's protections have again been delayed indefinitely. The Montana population is the last existing population of Arctic grayling in the lower 48 states. The Montana's grayling's nearly 30-year wait for protection is a travesty, said Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Program Director at the Center. Like the previous administration, the Obama administration is failing to provide prompt protection for wildlife that desperately needs it. And in our final story for tonight, the Center for Biological Diversity petitions to protect a rare Arizona orchid. To defend a tiny flower from a mile-wide, half-mile-deep proposed copper mine, the Center for Biological Diversity has filed a scientific petition to protect the Coleman's coral root orchid under the Endangered Species Act. One of just three populations of the rare pinkish-purple flower found only in Arizona's Sky Islands region is in the Santa Rita Mountains in the footprint of the planned Rosemont copper mine, which would suck up the region's water and cause water, air, and noise pollution. Determined to stop the destructive mine from harming endangered plants and animals, the center has already petitioned to protect four other species in its path, the Rosemont and Sonoran talus snails and the Bartram stonecrop and beardless cinchweed, both plants. The mine would also destroy habitat for several already protected species, including the jaguar, lesser long-nosed bat, and Chiricahua leopard frog. This gorgeous lily is severely threatened by the proposed Rosemont mine, as well as by livestock grazing, drought, and trampling by recreationists, say Tierra Curry, a center biologist. One population has already been lost, and without protection, the species is at risk of disappearing entirely. And we want to thank the Center for Biological Diversity for all their news, and you can get more news about biological diversity from their website, www.biologicaldiversity.org. And that's all the time we have for environmental news tonight on the Earth First Update. Tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another Earth First Update. In the meantime, if you like to download or listen to a podcast of this Earth First Update or previous Earth First Updates, please visit the website www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and select Earth First Radio. Once again, that website, www.h2opodcast.com. And we thank the folks at H2O Podcast for recording and archiving these shows. The Earth First Update is produced by Earth First Radio in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening, and do tune in for another edition of Earth First Update next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and www.freakradio.org. I'm Uncle Dennis.